Prime Minister, ladies and gentlemen, it is a very real and very great pleasure for me to welcome you all to the LSE this evening. This is the second of our Good Society lectures, and I think we could hardly have done better than with our speaker tonight. Prime Minister Gro Harlem Brundtland comes from a very political family. Her father was Norwegian Minister of Social Affairs and then, in the early 60s, Minister for Defence. And she became involved in political work at an early age and was active within the youth and student movement of the Norwegian Labour Party. But she actually trained as a doctor, a medical doctor, and graduated in medicine from the University of Oslo in 1963. She then went to Harvard, where she studied a Master of Public Health. And from 1966 to 1968, she served as a medical officer at the Norwegian Director of Health. Following that, she was assistant medical director at the Board of Health of the city of Oslo. So she had a long and very serious medical career. However, that political background pulled, and she entered politics and was extremely successful. Not only was she the first woman to become Prime Minister of Norway, but at 41, she was also the youngest Norwegian ever to become Prime Minister, a very rare and very unusual double first. Prime Minister, this is hardly an achievement of the same kind, but we are extremely grateful to you for coming and giving us the second Good Society lecture.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And first of all, I want to thank Dr. Ashworth and the LSE for inviting me to speak. It is a privilege to be here, an institution of worldwide fame, belonging to the International Premier League of Academic Excellence. When I was fortunate to speak to the international, another of the same type of institutions, the Harvard University, last summer, it was at the commencement celebrations last year. I had studied for Master of Public Health, as was mentioned, and thereby was asked to give the commencement speech. And during that those hours where we were standing there at Harvard Square, I listened to an eloquent Harvard student talk about the proposition of a credo for Harvard and suggested Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. And he made it mean to run the economy, to run the government, and born to run the whole country. For the LSE, I assume a more pragmatic line would have been chosen, such as Rule Britannia, along with a number of equally subdued titles. Well, our time is characterized by rapid change, social insecurity, and political instability. The forces of technology, of finance, and of electronic communication have increasingly taken over the powers which have been vested in democracy to shape our future. This situation is in fact new to our generation. Powerful forces threaten to take their own course. And let me say very directly and frankly at the opening of this speech that liberalism and ultra-conservatism dominated in the 80s, but that today we can clearly see that they failed and how they failed. Only a few decades ago, our agenda was simpler. Government efforts were aimed at keeping security and increasing prosperity. Our present predicament is new to this generation. We now have the knowledge that if present trends continue, we will soon face environmental collapse. Over the past century, industrial production has multiplied 50-fold. We may project a future world economy multiplying first 5-fold, then 10-fold. The world population is now approaching 6 billion. We may project a world population doubling or tripling sometime in the next century. 90% of the population increase is taking place in developing countries, many of which are unable today to feed their present population. The number of people living in absolute poverty is now 1 billion. And this number is still growing, outstripping economic growth in large parts of the world. Poverty is not only an insult but to human dignity, but also a cause of environmental degradation. People who are poor are forced to cultivate marginal lands, which are prone to erosion, or to cut down forests for new arable land. Many rely on fuel wood for energy, and their search for wood leads to deforestation and drought or floods, depending on the regional situation. If, however, the third world were to adopt our present Western level of consumption, we would need 10 worlds to provide enough resources for all the people early in the next century, and to absorb the byproducts of human activities, such as pollution and waste. The mountains of garbage and other solid wastes have roughly doubled over the past three decades. Hundreds of millions of tons of hazardous wastes are generated annually. About £1 billion of pesticides are produced annually. It must be clear that such practices just cannot continue. Perhaps the threat of global warming is the best example of how our economic systems are causing problems that can do irreversible and fatal damage to the planet which we share together. This is why we are compelled to manage a transition more important than the agricultural and industrial revolutions. Whereas previously we could be concerned with distribution of wealth and resources among the present generations, we are now faced with the Herculean task of distributing resources between present and future generations. We have the option to ruin this planet, but we also have the option to save it, to chart a new course. We would fail terribly in our duties if we neglect to implement the concept of sustainable development, as defined by the World Commission on Environment and Development, which means to meet the needs and aspirations of the present generation without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. This was, in essence, the mandate of the UN Conference on Environment and Development last year, one that could only partially be fulfilled. And this was the conference in Rio that you will remember. The challenge before us is made even greater by the endemic unemployment which now afflicts much of the industrialized world. About 20 million people are out of work in Western Europe alone. 100 billion ECU is being spent on unemployment compensation and far less on active measures for re-employment. This is a gigantic waste which we cannot afford, not least when so many pressing needs are unmet. Our challenges are great, but so are our opportunities. Never before have we had so much knowledge. Never before greater capacity. What we must do is to use our collective resources to promote the transition towards sustainable development. I am convinced that we can make this transition and that humankind has the potential to chart its own path towards the future. We need commitment, we need compassion and conviction, and we need to rededicate our governments and democratic systems to pursue an intergenerational type of solidarity. Although our Western systems of democracy and social market economy have come a long way in meeting people's needs, basic needs, there are new needs arising. Common needs, international needs, which require that people act politically. We have been successful in abolishing much hard manual labor and physical strain, but we have not been equally successful in creating new job opportunities. Reliance on the forces of the market alone is clearly insufficient. However good market mechanisms are at allocating resources effectively, the market alone will never provide full employment, environmental excellence, or social justice. It is obvious that there are no alternatives to active government and active involvement by government in solving the present problems with which our and future generations will be faced. The challenge will require that we aim at defining the appropriate role for governments and for governments acting together through international institutions. We need to set new directions for our societies, and in the West, we used to find our identity, our purpose, in opposing communism and totalitarian rule. We could be proud of our achievements and put them in perspective by pointing at the political and social mischief of other systems. Today, this approach will provide little comfort for all those millions who are out of work and have less security than that our children will enjoy continued progress. Since I'm speaking at an institution wedded to the spirit of inquisitive rationalism, I suppose it would be appropriate to ask, the good society, has not this topic aroused enough anxiety and fanaticism in this century? So much, indeed, that we ought not to address it in such a grand fashion. Should we not approach the issue as one of gradual reform, as a process of change and transformation, more in the spirit of the kind of Fabian society reforms practiced by the founders of the LSE, Beatrice and Sidney Webb? The demise of communism also most probably meant the end of a long, powerful tradition in political thought, at least in the foreseeable future, the search for utopia. This is the attempt to extract from history immutable laws which could guide political action and make individual freedom redundant. Karl Marx, who in the generous spirit of English tolerance was allowed to do his work not far away from here, more than 100 years ago, said, "Freedom lies in realizing what is necessary." And what is necessary could be deduced from discernible development trends of human society, traceable to the growth of the means of production and the attendant tensions, making total revolution the necessary outcome of the ensuing class struggle. The fate of communism is a constant reminder that politics alone cannot provide satisfactory answers to every challenge or aspect of life. A fellow social democrat, Helmut Schmidt, used to say, "Ich bin nicht der Vordenker der Nation." I am not the nation's prime philosopher. If the political arena is so constructed, it becomes overburdened and is liable to foster fanaticism and simplistic and even dangerous answers and outcomes. And still, we have yet to see any viable alternative to political activity when it comes to providing direction and purpose. In contemporary politics, we need to address fundamental questions. Without this, democracy runs the risk of becoming pedestrian and technical. A former social democratic prime minister of my own country, Mr. Bratteli, said that politics is more than managing the gross national product. How then can we strike a balance between politics as ersatz metaphysics and politics as nothing but administration? Where in the range between the Scylla of total commitment and the Charybdis of prolonging the status quo should we define, as Lincoln said at Gettysburg, government of the people, by the people, for the people? It is most appropriate to address this subject here in the academic home of Sir Karl Popper, whose attacks on the grandiose ideological style of thought in works like The Open Society and Its Enemies and The Poverty of Historicism have now been cruelly vindicated by history. Instead, Sir Karl admonishes us to seek the gradualist path by trial and error to be piecemeal social engineers. Such a method of critical rationalism and reforms allows us to adjust our course as we gain new knowledge and new insights to synthesize progressively social visions and realities. Sir Karl tried to make this commitment to the weak and flickering flame of rationality as fulfilling as the commitment to ideological belief in total systems. This perhaps provides a partial answer to a challenge which is constantly with us, the pursuit of rationalism in politics. Democracy is the only acceptable framework for any sustainable change, since it embodies necessary corrections. Democracy reacts both when the course of politics is wrong and when the course is right but the pace is wrong. Democracy gives us room to learn by forcing us to listen to our adversaries, to see our political opponents not only as obstacles in the path to accomplish goals, but also as potential sources of insight and new solutions. It is precisely because democracy has a built-in mechanism for acquiring new insights, for adjustments, for learning from others, that it has proved to be superior. People are used to holding politicians accountable, to measure their results and how they are able to improve our lives. If politicians' results do not meet expectations, we have seen disturbing trends, even here in Europe, that people are quick to turn against politicians and even against the political system itself. And there is a risk of alienation towards political life if this is allowed to continue, turning away as if you have no responsibility for anything. It's very usual today. We may risk a gradual disintegration also of traditional political institutions. What people, I think, must never forget and never be left to forget is that it is people themselves in a democracy who are responsible for how our democracies work. One cannot passively wait for someone else to do the job or put all faith in an illusion of omnipotence at the top political level. All segments of our societies must participate, must become more deeply involved in the real issues of our time. Democracy, therefore, cannot be achieved by top-down processes. It must have its base in our communities, in the minds and priorities of the individual, citizen, and voter, in political parties, and in the network of interest groups and non-governmental organizations, which are an essential part of our pluralistic societies. Has not the utopian tradition and the crimes and aberrations committed in its name in the 20th century contaminated this whole, what we might call, holistic approach and condemned us to seeking middle range and more easily attainable reforms? The human temperament is always on the lookout for grandiose remedies for all of society's ills. This obviously has a beneficial dimension. Without passions and convictions, like the ones we often witness in the younger generation, our societies would face decline, ossify, or even develop that kind of structural fatigue so vividly described in Gibbon's classical work on the decline of Rome. In the social democratic view, the government, as an agent of its principles, the citizens, has the primary responsibility for promoting the development of a good society. Such a concept of government naturally implies an active, conscious use of power and authority guided by the basic ideas of freedom, equality, and solidarity. Scandinavian social democracy has traditionally endeavored to find a workable compromise between capital and labor within the framework of representative democracy. The basic idea has been to humanize capitalism and the market mechanism, not to overthrow them. By extracting from capitalism its huge potential for growth and job creation, while protecting crucial areas from the unbridled impact of market forces. These areas are provision of healthcare, access to education, enjoyment of culture, and increasingly environmental protection. All of them underpin and are prerequisites for the wider concept of a meaningful life, such as the sense of living in a just society. Not every inequality is unjust, but every unjust inequality must be a target for action. In these important areas, the power of money has been balanced by politics designed to equalize access and distribution of rights. Social democrats have not claimed to have created the good society, but the political system associated with the term the Scandinavian model has had a great attraction because of its combination of three elements: the improvement and expansion of social, health, and educational services, maximum participation in employment, especially for women, and through active state intervention, sustained full employment. These elements have been exercised within the framework of open economies and international cooperation. Now, underlying the social democratic policy of the pragmatic partnership between economic efficiency and social compassion is a concept of the state which sees its prime function in providing guarantees for the individual that whatever their individual circumstances, certain minimum standards will be met. In a changing world, where strong forces operate across boundaries and between continents, governments must develop new means of governance, means that are workable on the international level. This is necessary to balance up the various interests and goals in the pursuance of the common good, enlarging and unleashing new opportunities for humankind and future generations. Of course, the role of the state has been under heavy attack from the right in recent years. The argument has been that the freedom of the individual is enhanced by the withdrawal of the state. But the kind of freedom envisaged by the right leads to liberty for the successful. It leads to freedom to succeed or to fail. And those who fail will invariably suffer a significant diminution of freedom. The state which social democrats would like to see is a state which claims as its foundation the equal rights of every member of society simply by virtue of citizenship, and which is the servant of all people rather than the protector of privilege. Modern governance and government must aim at distributing not only political power, but also economic power. It must stand for the distribution of power in society for the sake of the individual, and it must empower the individual to take part and enrich the political process at all levels of society. What this means is that the more formal processes of democracy have to be supplemented by the devolution of power, allowing for greater integration between the formal and voluntary aspects of political action. One such political purpose is to harness technology to meet human needs. We all know how arduous such a task is. In countries like my own, this is clearly seen in what could be called the post-industrial dilemma. By means of technology, industrial production has been made more effective, but its volume has increased appreciably without a corresponding gain in employment. Jobless growth is a disturbing threat. We can produce more without putting more people to work. This kind of rationalization also has socially detrimental effects because it eliminates low-skilled, labor-intensive jobs, making education more and more a sine qua non for employment. A Europe beset by unemployment and potential social unrest calls for the conscious use of technology to create a new variety of jobs at different levels of skill. As a goal, this is not new. Many of you may recall how the first Wilson cabinet in 1964 made the socially conscious use of technology, the white heat of technology, training, and apprenticeship cornerstones of its programs. Even as early as 1942 and 1944, the famous Beveridge reports set out social and political ground rules prescribing social solidarity, citizenship rights, and collective action. The 1990s, too, call for setting a new course. The Commission on Social Justice, headed by John Smith, says it clearly: failure of demand can, of course, cause a recession. But failure of supply, above all, lack of investment in skill, research, capital, and infrastructure, is the cause of chronic economic weakness and long-term unemployment. The importance of technology to the modern industrial economy is obvious. Technology threatens to increase the concentration of power in the hands of those who control capital. The increasingly capital-intensive nature of much modern economic activity has steadily increased the importance of capital in wealth creation. At the same time, the role of the owner, in the traditional capitalist sense of the word, is receding as more and more resources are controlled by anonymous entities, trusts and funds, where the individual interests is fragmented and where the role of the wage-earning managers responsible only to the stock market tends to increase in importance. The technology to move money across borders has also contributed to the internationalization of capital and hence diminished national opportunities for political control of the economy. Many thought that capitalism had on the whole succeeded in solving the problem of growth and job creation. What was left to do for governments, and in particular for social democratic governments, was to fine-tune the economy and safeguard more equal distribution. For this purpose, the state's fiscal controls were long held to be sufficient. With the perforation of these controls by the internationalization of capital, the premise of this argument is weakened. Indeed, this means a whole new agenda for social democracy in Europe. Our ability to cope with the employment challenge will determine whether we succeed or fail in the next phase of European cooperation. We will need radical measures and rethinking of old concepts. The closing years of this century will be dominated by a continuous adaptation to a new kind of international economy where the key means of creating wealth will be development of human resources. The demands on governments for an active labor market policy are obvious. The idea of an active labor market policy was originally devised during a period of high employment. It consisted in keeping the productivity growth of the economy high, allowing for wage increases and alleviating transfer of labor to expanding industries by retraining and subsidizing vocational and geographical mobility. Today, the active labor market policy of countries like Norway is designed not only to secure income for the unemployed, but to maintain and improve the ability to work through training and short-term employment programs. The review of these policies by the OECD strongly support our conclusion that active measures are preferable to the passive disbursement of employment benefits. There are no easy solutions or quick fixes to the challenges that we face. The room for maneuver in stabilization policies is limited in most countries. As stated by the Commission on Social Justice, and I quote, national governments have to work within a macroeconomic framework increasingly determined by others, end of quote. And this, of course, is absolutely correct. Nevertheless, since the power of individual states has been eroded by international interdependency, it is essential to intensify efforts and international cooperation broadly defined. Governments must contribute constructively to reduction of uncertainty by strengthening international economic cooperation. Last year, the EFTA countries and the EC completed negotiations on the creation of a European Economic Area. When the EEA agreement enters into force in January, we will create the world's largest single market, consisting of 18 countries. That is a major achievement. Europe will be in a much better position to take advantage of its innovative and creative potential. Our industries will be better placed in global competition. If we had not removed barriers, adopted common rules, and increased cooperation, the problem of unemployment would have been even much worse. 1 year ago, Norway took the initiative to strengthen cooperation between the EFTA and EC countries in the field of growth and employment. Last April, our ministers met to address the issue together for the first time. The EFTA countries have since cooperated on a substantial contribution to the EC so-called White Book on growth, competitiveness, and employment. I believe agreeing on the main policy thrust of such a white book is no easy task. In fact, I know it's not easy. Defining common strategy on how to confront our current crisis must reconcile various political complexions in Europe and can become a divisive and difficult operation. I believe that firmer economic and monetary cooperation in Europe is absolutely essential. The recent monetary turbulence has brought back memories of times when one country could export its internal problems to its neighbor by means of currency devaluations. At the end of the day, we would all end up as losers. Moreover, we cannot combat growth and unemployment by cutting social efforts. Such policies will only prolong and deepen the crisis. The only viable remedy is better coordinated economic policies among European countries. Agreed investment programs, in particular in infrastructure, transport, training, as well, and not least, in environmental protection. The connection between high unemployment, trade frictions, and social unrest should not be allowed to develop into a vicious circle. Fair burden sharing and just distribution policies are called for also on the international level. We cannot choose between economic growth and sustaining the environment. That is no real choice. From a global viewpoint, growth is imperative if poverty is to be alleviated. Growth is necessary to create the resources needed to solve environmental problems. While political parties used to be organized around clearly distinguishable poles of socio-economic interest, or in some cases religious or regional cleavages, environmental concerns transcend today ordinary political boundaries. The environment represents a completely new kind of challenge to modern society and to governments. Environmental destruction is egalitarian in the way that its effects are felt by all citizens, all strata of society, although some, because of unequal distribution of wealth, may be temporarily able to protect themselves somewhat better against environmental decays than others. Moreover, environmental degradation is not always visible. It requires a minimum knowledge and capacity for planning to take an active part in abating effects that will make their impacts felt in the future. Such is the situation with climate change. Nowadays, we have numerous examples of people's inclination to adopt simplistic issues as symbols of environmental consciousness. Some kinds of environmentalism may even trigger what I would call a true believer mentality, which probably serves the same deep-seated existential needs as the old utopian ideologies. Genuine environmental problems must be of primary concern to any government's efforts at creating a good society. This is a main conclusion in what I wish to share with you today. I come from a country where one of the most important environmental issues is acid rain, 90% of which is imported from other countries, a substantial share from Britain. Faced with the decay of our natural environment and our neighboring countries telling us that for the time being they are unable to curb their emissions more effectively, Norway obviously would be best served by international agreements allowing for a system of majority voting in order to force those moving at snail's pace to act on the problem. Well, snails had a role also in a decision from the law of tort delivered in 1932 by Lord Atkin. The litigation had a rather pedestrian origin. An opaque bottle of ginger beer had been sold with a snail in it. The decision was delivered based on an extension of the rule of law to relationship between individuals, that we all owe a duty to care for our neighbor, a duty to act in a reasonable way to avoid injury to him or her. The same principle, in fact, was set out with regard to the relations between states and their impact on the environment in other states at the Stockholm Conference on the Human Environment in 1972. And repeated now at Rio 20 years later. States have a right to exploit their own natural resources, and they have the responsibility to ensure that activities within their jurisdiction do not cause damage to other states. The massive environmental degradation in Russia is also a most serious concern to neighboring states, not least to Norway. Events in recent years have revealed that the northern regions of Russia are facing major ecological crisis. The emissions of sulfur dioxide from two nickel plants just a few kilometers from the Norwegian border town of Kirkenes are three times larger than the total level of emission coming from whole of Norway. The safety of nuclear power stations on the Kola Peninsula is also a source of great concern, as are the nuclear waste deposits from the fleet of icebreakers and obsolete warships. Dumping at sea represents a threat, not only to Norway, but to other countries as well, due to the sea currents flowing out of the Barents region. It is not sufficient to contain and prevent future environmental degradation. Active steps are indeed needed to reverse by means of a sustained long-term effort, which will be very costly. The magnitude of the problem, of course, far exceeds Russia's own capacity to deal with them. Broad-based international efforts will be needed. It is of vital interest to us all that Russia be integrated into binding multilateral cooperation with a stable democratic zone in Europe. The risks of chaos in our immediate vicinity are greater than the risks of well-organized Russian moves against the interest in the West, of the West. There is no invisible hand that will lead us to stability, to peace and development. No matter how strong the political will, there is no single national road to full employment, to monetary stability, to low interest rates, or environmental excellence. These challenges are common to all. The concept of integration has become the recipe for the survival of the nation states. When so many of the forces influencing our future are indeed operating on the international level, we must also lift democratic decision-making up to that same level, and I want to underline, in addition to the levels where they already exist. A weakened Europe, politically and economically, would also weaken the new democracies in the Central and Eastern Europe, who look to us and our institutions for hope, renewal, and identity. A weakened Europe would have tragic consequences for the Third World, for which we Europeans, with our history in this and other nations, in the colonial times, have a special responsibility. The 1990s will decide whether the choices for our children will narrow yet further or whether they will open up. We know more about population, environment, and development than ever before. We have the basis for action. We know what to do, and now we must mobilize people in every country and in every walk of life, not least, of course, the political leaders and the mass media. George Bernard Shaw said that the worst sin toward our fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent to them. Let us fight the indifference which has prevailed in the past and move towards that equilibrium within and across generations, which we call sustainable development. Let us use our political institutions and human creativity to find the balance between the number of people and the level of distribution of consumption which the carrying capacity of our earth can sustain. Let us listen to the voice of unborn generations and make the earth the hospitable place that any human being deserves. First of all, lastly, this is where I wish to end this speech, by calling upon all of us together to see that we are the first generation to face a new kind of request for solidarity. Not only to look at the distribution between the people on the globe today and between us and those generations that we can see before us, but the fact that our way of leading our societies, of carrying on our consumption and production patterns and our distribution, will have an impact on the free choice of future generations in a way that was not the case in the beginning of this century, when it was enough to show concern for your fellow human beings of today. We have the challenge that we must do what is right, also to save the potential and the opportunity for coming generations yet unborn. Thank you.
Prime Minister has very kindly, and I think rather bravely, if I may say so, agreed to answer questions, and we have time for about 10 minutes worth. But before I ask you to put up your hand and ask questions, could I explain, Prime Minister, that alas, we weren't able to house everybody who wanted to hear you in this auditorium, and there has been, whilst you've been talking, another lecture theatre full of students and our guests, to whom your words have been carried by the microphone, and there's a television camera up there too. and they've been watching you. they've been watching you on that. But in order that they hear the questions that are to be asked, I will need to speak in here and repeat them. Otherwise, they will won't know what it is you're addressing. So, if you could bear with me in that, if you could ask your question, I will then repeat it for the benefit of that unseen audience that is in the new theatre. Questions at the back. The question is that all leading politicians in virtually all countries of the world are encouraging economic growth within their own national borders. Do you, Prime Minister, think that this is compatible with your idea of sustainable development?
I think the student qualified a little differently. He said... yeah.
My apologies.
He also took, the aspect of increased consumption, as I understood you, by each individual in rich countries. May I add to your question something which I also addressed yesterday at the London Business School, where I, in my speech, directly... focused on the consumption and production patterns even more than I did today, and saying the following. It is a question not only to the rich countries, but of how their consumption pattern is, but also to the rich parts of the poor countries. We should never forget that there are great numbers of people in the South, living at a high level and at least at the average and more of the level of consumption and use of natural resources that we have, for instance, in Europe. And that is very often forgotten. The question is not what country you live in and the average consumption in that country, but it is, in fact, that you have a reasonable consumption pattern and a distribution pattern within society which is fair and reasonable. And I really think that what we have done in Norway, for instance, is not only asking but deciding on behalf of people by voting in Parliament to increase a carbon tax much, much to higher levels than in other countries, which means people will have to pay much more for their gasoline, their petroleum bills. The industries will have to pay much more for using pollutive substances and the kind of energy which is polluting our atmosphere and increasing the climate problem. However, at the same time, more energy needs to be used in many poor countries where people are starving because of the lack of resources. So there is a great redistributive problem in the global economy, and we have no right to continue a type of industrial production which misuses and overuses natural resources. And this is why I mentioned technology and knowledge as important aspects of the solution. We can step by step and deliberately bring down the burden that we place on the carrying capacity of the earth. We have to, and some countries have up to now done more in that direction than others. I will not mention names.
I think, good, yes, up there. The question, and I'll try and get it right this time.
No, no.
the question is that although the defense of democracy and the gradual social engineering that Karl Popper recommended is clearly close to what you believe, do you really think that that kind of gradualism will cope with the dramatic changes and dramatic environmental degradation which we see?
Well, I'm convinced that the alternative of some kind of revolution will not help. And so, simply, it is clear that it is the spreading of knowledge and the awareness of what is necessary that is the only way forward. But we don't have very much time, so we are dependent upon students of economics and of biology and of all the other disciplines to take this seriously and in our countries be helping through the way that they use their knowledge, the way they work and the way they participate in democracies to make it possible to make the necessary decisions through international agreements. This is really, and through changes in the content of industry and industrial growth. And I agree with you, it is really a dilemma that we don't have too much time. We need to increase the conditions of people in developing countries, the poor people in developing countries, that is, for them to choose and to have a chance to choose to have fewer children. Because they can get the knowledge which they need in order to make those decisions, and that they have some hope for their future lives, that they believe that if they have 3 children instead of 10, they will have grown up 3 children, instead of adding to the number to be certain that they are not alone without any when they are old and need their children's support. Now, this kind of condition needs, we need to realize the necessity of not losing too much time in helping to curb population growth by making the social changes which are necessary in health and education in poor countries, because otherwise we will all suffocate.
Now, you, sir.
Well, let me take one
Could
sorry.
I, sorry.
You have to. It's very hard to keep back, you know.
This gives you thinking time, Prime Minister. the questioner said that the Prime Minister ended her speech with a slogan for international cooperation, which he and many like him from the developing world had heard many times. Could she give examples of practical things which could be done to bring about that international cooperation for which he was calling?
Well, let me mention 2 more practical examples. They are not politically easy, but they should have been. The OECD countries have, in the United Nations, said that they will pay at least 0.7% of their GDPs for development aid. They did that 20 or 25 years ago. Very few countries have done so. They have even reduced from a level around half of that number in recent years. So some countries, and I'm not naming them here, are below 0.20 or 30 or even below 0.20 in development aid. Now, this is not acceptable because it is absolutely necessary to reach people in those countries with education, with vaccines for their children, with health services, so that they have a chance for a better life and to improve their ability to create jobs, employment, and to get their own economic growth coming. Now that's one. Then we have made another principle decision in the UNDP that those countries who give countries who give development aid should use at least 20% for what is called, you know, basic human needs, like the ones I have mentioned. 20% of those budgets for those purposes. Some countries do, among them Norway. We think that it would be greatly helpful if that would happen in all those countries that are engaged in development aid. And of course, we also have three times the level of the average of OECD countries in Norway for development aid. And we have kept it, even during recession, at a level which is three times the level of the average. Now, I think more countries can afford to do it, and they need to do it. Another example is, I think some of the developing countries have to take seriously that the rich people in their countries have to pay more taxes, have to do what people in our countries have done by moving the difference between the classes of society, having the rich paying more and the poor paying less, and in that way redistributing the income and the wealth of those nations. I also think, as we do, we speak directly and clearly to some of our development aid recipient countries that if you don't lower the fraction of your public budget that goes for the military, we are not willing to fill in your health and education service the way we have done. So this is not a simple question of just for every developing country, you know, asking the rich countries in the north to pay the bills. No, it's a two-way street. And it's also necessary for us to have, and this is for us in the industrialized world, first of all now, to finalize the Uruguay round, not to be so protectionist and so self-serving in your interest that you are not able to conclude after many years of discussion, now that all the groups of countries, and the developing countries especially, have now a result in this that will open the world markets to the developing countries to a greater extent. This is what we need to do, but there are still some stumbling blocks, I hope. We will succeed in moving them away in the coming weeks because there is now a new time limit set in the middle of December, and I'm hoping for wisdom in sufficient numbers of countries for this to happen.
Three people have caught my eye. You, sir, in the... The questioner has asked the Prime Minister whether or not she would not regard the killing of whales by Norwegians as objectionable to people in this country, as is our exporting of acid rain from Britain to Norway, and how she reconciles her country's policy towards whales with her wider interests in environmental matters.
You know, I'm very glad that this question was raised. Because it gives me an opportunity to tell you what this is about. Let me start by saying that during the 70s, when I was Minister of the Environment, when the scientific evidence came in on the dangerous impacts to nature of acid rain, I had a terrible struggle to convince in the international fora where I could get to as an environment minister, in the OECD, in the ECE, the Economic Commission for Europe, to fight to get accept in other countries of the fact that what was happening was dangerous to the future of all our countries. What I did was also increasing the scientific funding, the funding for scientific research in my own country, and I think by our activity helping to increase the research in other countries to find out the scientific basis for an evaluation of the issue. It took me many years, and until Margaret Thatcher visited Norway in 1986, it had not been accepted by Britain at the official level that acid rain in fact had the background of spreading of pollution due to the burning of fossil fuels and so on. But it was in 1986 accepted by your Prime Minister after the scientific work in England also had resulted in an unanimous evaluation. This was not to be pushed aside anymore. Now, what has this to do with the whaling issue? In the question of the Whaling Convention, this is an international body which Norway was one of the founding members to. It is a convention for the sustainable use and protection of whales. There are 70 different species of whales. Most of them had been badly over-caught for decades by all the countries of ours. The convention was a convention to manage the ocean resources in a respectable, long-term, and responsible way through international agreements. And Norway has done that. We have been fighting together with Britain to protect the whales that are threatened. Today, we have a unanimous scientific committee of the Whaling Convention. Not only now, but for the last couple of years, saying clearly that the minke whale has more than 80,000 specimens in our parts of the ocean in the North Atlantic. It is not a threatened species. And there is a unanimous scientific view that this resource can be, you know, at a reasonable small level, take a yearly catch to balance that resource. You must remember that Norway, as a country that has to manage ocean resources, can never respect what it was part of your question, that on the basis of sentiment in any country, that can be decisive for the management of natural resources. It is not a question of Norwegian sentiment about acid rain. It is a question of fact, which everybody has agreed, that it is destroying the nature of Norway. It is not the question of the sentiment of Norwegians that they don't like it to be destroyed. Certainly we don't. But it is being destroyed. And nobody questions that fact. This is why England has a responsibility to lower the impact not only on Norway, but on other European countries. But what if the Norwegian people decided in the Norwegian parliament, we don't like fox hunting. We expect the British parliament to respect the Norwegian decision that we don't like the practice of fox hunting.
Question at the back.
I
didn't hear it either. Could you come? I'm sorry, your voice doesn't carry. Could you come up to the? in the question is that in the light of your vision of Scandinavian social democracy, how do you view the blip in the Swedish model? Gosh, that's going to sound funny. I mean, but I'm sure you understand.
No, you know, yesterday in the London Business School, the last question that was posed to me was from someone in that auditorium asking me if I, on a philosophical or ideological basis, had made an opinion about what should be the correct or optimal balance between the public sector and the private sector as percentage of the GDP. I said, no. I don't have an ideological stance on this, but I can tell you what is the experience of the Norwegian social democracy on this. It is that while we, during the decades, from the first social democratic government in the 30s, had a gradual increase of the percentage of the GDP, building the welfare state, you may say, that was increasing, it came to a level of about 50% sometime in the early 80s. Since then, and it's now 10 years ago, we have tried to balance out and stabilize so that we can do what is necessary to have a good society by when you have new additional needs to make changes in the use of public expenditure in such a way that you don't gradually all the time eat into the half of the economy which is based on the private sector. So I say this because the Swedes have come beyond 50, and they have needed, I think, to bring that percentage down. It has been a little, you know, coming a little over the limit of what is good, sound, total politics. And in the recession and the difficulties of European economies in these last years, it has hit Sweden because they had to try to bring down to, you know, somewhat this percentage so that they could carry all the obligations which they feel are essential. And so I think not on ideological basis, but on a practical, a pragmatic basis, a good idea to have a mixed economy with a balance between what roles the government takes on behalf of us all and the vitality of the private economy. And I believe this, you know, you have to see whether you can find this good balance, and this is when you have the best society. And I can tell you that in 1986, when I took over government the second time, we had come into an economic crisis in Norway because of the great fall in the oil price in the spring of 86. And since Norwegian economy had been building up in the yuppie era during the conservative coalition, they had built up an overinvestment in Norwegian mainland and generally in our economy. When we had the fall in the oil price, it was impossible. We had a great deficit. We had to increase the interest rate terribly, and we had to balance out our finances. We did that over years. It was a tough thing, but we managed. And we have increased Norwegian competitiveness by 14% in those years without having a higher unemployment than nearly 6. It's much too high for us. But after all, it's a low number compared to other countries. And we have stabilized the level in the last year at around a level of 6, while employment numbers are increasing. Unemployment is still not falling, but we have more people employed than we had 1 year ago. So we are on the right track. And I think Sweden is working to get into balance. but it will not get into balance by reducing the percentage of GDP for all the important public expenditures, for instance, back to 40. I'm sure that would be destroying many values in the Swedish society, and indeed, education and health for all is areas that will require a government dimension of what I have talked about.
One last question for you, sir. The questioner is a Scandinavian and a believer, he says, in social liberalism, not liberal socialism. And he asks the Prime Minister whether all the people in Norway are keen to join the European Economic Area. Union. Economic Union.
Well, this we don't know, because the Norwegian people will decide this question by a referendum. But before that, the Norwegian government will continue and hopefully succeed in getting a good negotiating results with the EC. And before that, we cannot answer all the questions that Norwegians ask about what conditions will be there as a result of those negotiations. So at the moment, not only in Norway, but in nearly all European countries, there is a lot of pessimism around. There is a lot of uneasiness, a lot of pessimism about the future because of unemployment, because of the war in former Yugoslavia, because of all the political problems that are not solved. But the only solution to political problems that are not solved is to do better and to do more together and to find the solutions. So this is the kind of argument that we will have to carry, but we need to know that we are welcomed into Europe by a good negotiated results with the community. Norway is going to be a net contributor, in any case, to the community's economy, but we want the Norwegian fishermen to feel that in Europe they have understood that fish and living on fish is dependent on whether you have the closeness to nature and you have the dependency of it's where you live that decides how and if you can use the natural resources outside your own door.
Prime Minister, it was very kind of you to refer to us in your speech as an institution wedded to the spirit of inquisitive rationalism. That is indeed our aspiration, and you've just given us an object lesson in how that aspiration can be realized. I think it's also, if I guess a little, an object lesson in how to carry on that seminar that was begun in this place in 1949 by a group of students who, as grown up and I dare say slightly richer people, gave us the very generous benefaction which has enabled us to invite you here this evening to give us your version of the good society. And on behalf of them, and indeed on behalf of all those present here this evening, and on behalf of all those unseen in the other lecture theatre, can I thank you most warmly for having made such a sterling contribution to that debate in what I like to think of as in the best tradition, not only of the 1949 students, but indeed of all our students. Thank you very much indeed.